From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, what is the new role of the American military? We talk with retired Admiral Jean LaRocque, director of the Center for Defense Information, about yesterday's airstrike in Iraq, the U.S. military and the U.N., and how the military will fare in the transition between the Bush and Clinton presidencies. Also, we talk with former Texas Agricultural Commissioner Jim Hightower about populist politics in the 90s. He says the best way to communicate with the people is on the radio. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead makes a confession. He's hooked on the soap opera Santa Barbara, which goes off the air tomorrow. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. In an apparent reversal of campaign statements, President-elect Bill Clinton has said he'll continue the practice of intercepting Haitian boat people at sea and returning them to their island, NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Word came in a radio broadcast by Clinton to the people of Haiti, many of whom had concluded from his campaign statements that he would rescind the Bush administration's policy of forced repatriation of the boat people. After Clinton's election, there was a sharp increase in the construction of boats in Haiti, prompting today's radio message.
I fear that boat departures in the near future would result in further tragic losses of life. For this reason, the practice of returning those who flee Haiti by boat will continue for the time being after I become president.
The announcement is deeply disappointing to many human rights activists who say forced repatriation of Haitians is discriminatory and illegal. Clinton said today he'll make it easier for Haitians to apply for U.S. asylum while they're in Haiti and will work hard to restore democracy and improve living standards there so Haitians will not have to flee. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Public opinion polls released today indicate that most people surveyed say they approve of the Allied air attacks on Iraq, and a majority favors more attacks to drive Saddam Hussein from power. Polls taken last night by ABC News and Gallup found that 83% of respondents approved of the U.S.-led airstrikes. The Gallup poll found that 59% supported additional attacks until Saddam is forced out. Majorities in both polls said they don't believe that yesterday's airstrikes will induce Saddam to stop violating the UN ceasefire resolutions. About 1,000 soldiers from a Central Texas Army base are preparing to head to the Persian Gulf following yesterday's U.S. airstrikes against Iraq. Tracy Tong of member station KERA reports.
The 1st Cavalry troops from Fort Hood will join 300 Special Operation Forces already taking part in military exercises in Kuwait. This deployment is in conjunction with Wednesday's American and Allied strike against Iraqi installations. It will be the third tour for the members of the 1st Cavalry. Many participated in Operation Desert Storm 2 years ago, and some returned to the Middle East last summer and the fall for other training maneuvers. The general in command for Fort Hood described this latest trip as a training mission, but says the troops will be prepared for anything. The division will consist of 2 tank companies and 1 infantry fighting vehicle company. They will be assisted by combat and support units. It is not known at this time how long they will be gone. For National Public Radio, this is Tracy Tong.
Stock prices closed slightly higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 4 points to close at 3,267.8. This is NPR News. In Baghdad today, the Iraqi government offered cooperation with the United Nations while maintaining its belligerent rhetoric. Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz said that his government will permit UN weapons inspectors to fly their own planes into Iraq, and he pledged to suspend Iraqi incursions into Kuwait. At the same time, though, Aziz said that Iraq would take revenge for yesterday's air raids, and he gave no indication that Iraq would remove its anti-aircraft missile batteries from the southern no-fly zone. The British government announced today that Britain will increase its military presence in the Balkan region. From London, NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
Britain is sending the aircraft carrier Ark Royal to the Adriatic Sea off the coast of the former Yugoslavia, Defense Secretary Malcolm Rifkin told the House of Commons. In addition, the British government is sending 2 destroyers and 3 support ships carrying additional ground weaponry. Rifkind said the additional weapons would be used only should the need arise to reinforce British troops already in Bosnia. There are currently 2,400 British soldiers in the area protecting UN aid convoys. Yesterday, a British soldier was shot and killed. It was the first British forces fatality in Bosnia. So far, 23 soldiers serving with the UN Protection Force have been killed there. Rifkind said that a small number of specialist troops would be reinforcing the British contingent. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
The Federal Election Commission said today that voter turnout for the November election was the best for any presidential race since 1968. The commission said that 56% of the voting-age population took part in the election, a total of nearly 105 million people. The turnout was an all-time record for total voters. Curtis Gans of the Committee for the Study of the American Electorate said the record turnout was spurred by fears about the economy. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, the United States bombed Iraq. We have troops in Somalia and have considered the possibility of military action in Bosnia. The role of the U.S. military is changing as American foreign policy changes in the post-Cold War era. To help us examine some of the changes within the military, we called retired Rear Admiral Jean LaRocque. LaRocque is the founder of the Center for Defense Information, an independent research organization which analyzes military spending, policies, and weapons systems. LaRocque began his naval service in 1940, and during his 31 years in active service, he commanded a variety of warships, including destroyers and guided missile cruisers. For 7 years, he worked in the Pentagon on strategic planning for the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Chief of Naval Operations. I asked him about the center's reaction to yesterday's airstrike.
Politically, it seems like a very harsh way to send a message to try to get a point across to the Iraqi government that there ought to be some way to work at this diplomatically. We recognize at the Center for Defense Information that the military is a heavy-handed, blunt instrument, and we think it not wise to kill a few people in order to make a point with the government. Politically, I think it was President Bush wanting to take one last swipe at Saddam Hussein before he left office. And I think also it tended to put President Clinton in a box, or President-elect Clinton. Clinton had to say something, and he would be uncomfortable opposing it, so he came out in support of what President Bush had done, which rather locks Clinton into the same situation that President Bush is already in.
What about militarily?
Well, militarily, it was simply a mosquito bite on Saddam Hussein, so we knock out a few of their anti-aircraft missiles. Actually, of course, there was no threat to our planes if we didn't fly over Iraq. If we're going to fly over Iraq, then, of course, we might expect that our planes would indeed be threatened or endangered. But we are, by our own decision, deciding to fly over a sovereign territory that we have simply said we may do so, and we ought to do so with impunity.
What kind of military technology did we take out in Iraq?
Well, we took out some old surface-to-air missiles, SA-2s and SA-3s, the same kind that were used in Vietnam, which were effective in Vietnam. They do go up to about 80,000 feet, and they could easily, but not easily, but they could knock out our planes that fly into Iraq. We took out, apparently, some anti-aircraft artillery. But the fact is that the Pentagon has not really made a good evaluation yet as to what damage was actually done. And we also don't know how many people were killed, if any, although there's some reports emanating that at least some people were killed at an anti-aircraft battery.
Does this strike set any military precedent for us?
Well, we've actually been doing this for quite some time. It's just a matter of level. After all, we picked a fight with Gaddafi about 5-6 years ago, shot down a couple of his planes. We've been sending our forces to various places all over the world. After all, Grenada was simply one of a larger scale, Panama, larger scale. We in the United States have decided that we may, at any time we wish, whenever the president wishes, attack any country in the world. And, of course, we have the capability to bomb any country in the world within 24 hours with the aircraft based in the United States. Gives us a mighty long reach for our military force with quick reaction. And it's nothing new that we strike without warning. These are surprise attacks we made in Grenada, in Panama, and we did not tell the Iraqis when we were going to strike them. In fact, we've made something of a point of the fact that we're going to do this anytime we want, and there will be no more ultimatums.
I wonder if what you're saying is a fair criticism, because after all, Iraq was violating UN sanctions, and it was a multilateral force, not just a United States action.
Well, this was a United States action supported by the British and the French. This was not a United Nations action, and no one pretends that it was. The Security Council did not authorize it, and the Resolution 688, which the President used to justify some of our action over there recently, says nothing at all about a no-fly zone, says nothing about the 32nd parallel, says nothing about shooting down Iraqi planes. That's all a U.S. action supported by the British and the French. Yes, there were some violations of the United Nations resolutions, to wit that we, the United Nations was now being denied by the Iraqis the opportunity to fly United Nations planes into Iraq, but that and one other minor one were negotiable. They could be handled with diplomacy, but we've taken it upon ourselves to use military action to ensure compliance south of the 32nd parallel based solely on the decision that the United States, France, and Britain made. Nothing to do with there's nothing in the UN Resolution 688 that even remotely suggests that authorizes U.S. military action in that part of Iraq.
What was the center's position on the intervention in Somalia?
Well, we're divided here at the center on that issue. Some of the military feel that it was an improper use of military force to by any measure. Personally, I supported the use of the military force, the military forces to go in and feed those starving people. I would hope that we'll be out of there in 6 months. I hope we can turn it over at that time to the United Nations. This was an urgent humanitarian effort, which seemed to me to demand the attention of the world community. The world community did not seem to be able to get its act together to do it. In the meantime, people were literally dying before our eyes. So I supported sending the forces in there to feed the people and then urge our government to turn it over to the UN as quickly as possible.
What kind of budget changes await the military now?
Well, we're spending now at about the same level for the military that we spent during the height of the Cold War. The budget this year was $292 billion, almost $6 billion a week. And there is talk of reducing our military forces in size, and that should act to reduce our military spending. However, both Clinton and President Bush, but even more so President-elect Clinton, have supported weapons that even the Pentagon doesn't want. So the spending for the military will remain at about the same level as it is today, $6 billion a week.
Is the military being reshaped technologically or in terms of its troops because of the new kinds of deployment that we're seeing, the new kinds of foreign policy initiatives?
Not really. There's talk about that it ought to be done, but we're still building Cold War weapons to fight a nuclear war against somebody, presumably the Russians and the Ukrainians. In the meantime, of course, we are continuing to develop planes for rapid deployment, that is, weapons for rapid deployment carried out by aircraft, and more light divisions, light infantry to facilitate going elsewhere in the world. So in one sense, we're still doing the old Cold War fighting capability development. At the same time, we're building forces to facilitate intervention elsewhere in the world.
I'm interested in what you think of Bill Clinton's choice of Les Aspin as Secretary of Defense and Warren Christopher as Secretary of State.
Well, I know nothing about Warren Christopher, except for reading the papers, but I do know Les Aspin, and he certainly is a knowledgeable guy. I worked with him in the Pentagon when he was there as one of the whiz kids under Mr. McNamara. Les Aspin is a thoughtful man, PhD, and he knows the military. And he came out in February this last year with a series of options. He indicated to Leon Panetta in a personal letter that supported option C, as he called it, which would have been a significant reduction in our military force structure. If he sticks to that, it'd be a very wise choice.
Are there certain changes that you're looking for under a Clinton administration or that you expect to happen under a Clinton administration?
Well, the Clinton administration, Mr. Clinton himself, promised a reduction of our military forces down to 1,400,000 active people. He said he was going to cut $60 billion more out of the military budget than President Bush had planned to do, but that's over a period of about 4 years, so it's not a significant cut. It would appear to me there'll be some modest reductions in our military force structure, but there'll be an improved capability to intervene around the world with that military structure, but the military spending will remain at about the same level that it is today.
What kind of debate do you think is happening within the military right now about the direction it should head in?
Well, the military is, I'm still convinced that they believe that if they maintain a strong military posture and with the capability to attack, destroy, and kill efficiently, they can serve their country best. Now, that leaves open the possibility that the United States might establish a strictly humanitarian force of hospital ships, medical personnel, civilian administrators that could be used as a disaster relief force. I think as a nation, if we wish to get into that, then we ought to proceed in that direction, expand our FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency, to take care of conditions in other countries. But I do not think it is wise to try to have the military perform functions for which it was not designed. If you want to waste your money, put it through the Pentagon. Pentagon is the most wasteful system we have in terms of spending money. If we want to have a humanitarian outfit, let's design one to serve that purpose, or put our money into the Red Cross or the United Nations or other groups, but not confuse the role of the military with the humanitarian effort on a permanent basis.
My guest is retired Rear Admiral Jean LaRocque, director of the Center for Defense Information. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Admiral Jean LaRocque, director of the Center for Defense Information in Washington, D.C. Admiral, you recently returned from 2 weeks traveling around the world examining the effectiveness of U.N. peacekeeping forces. You went to Cambodia, Cyprus, Syria, Israel, and El Salvador. What specifically were you looking for?
Well, we were trying to decide whether the United Nations forces were doing any good and whether they were worth the money we were spending on them. And whether or not we could continue to put more forces around the world.
Who organized the trip?
the United Nations Association and the president went with this, President Luck, and it was a very interesting trip of about 16 people, three of us military, one on active duty, and two of us retired officers. And it was very illuminating to see what was happening in each of those countries.
Could you give us a summary report of what you saw?
Well, each country, of course, is different. I think Cambodia is the most complex. We have about 45 to 50,000 UN peacekeeping forces in that country. There are only about 10 or 15 Americans there, however. But the costs are very high. The costs are running about $2 billion a year in Cambodia, and the United States pays 30% of that for the peacekeeping. We pay 25% of the regular budget. But I think it's a mission impossible there. Actually, I don't think that's his actual title, Prince Sihanouk met with us for about 5 hours, and he said that the United Nations has turned his country into a colony of the United Nations, and I think there's some substance to that. He said that you all will be out of here before long because you don't have enough money to stay. It's costing the UN about $2 billion a year. I think it's a mission impossible for the United Nations to get in and try to register everybody, repatriate the Cambodians that have gone over to Thailand, keep the Vietnamese out, and hold elections and establish a government.
In examining the peacekeeping forces, did you reach any conclusion about how peacekeeping forces have to be trained or equipped differently than forces who are dispatched to fight war?
Well, interestingly enough, the peacekeeping forces are not trained at all. Take the situation in Cambodia. The United Nations decides to send X number of troops there. Then you go around to the various countries of the world and say, will you send a company, a brigade, or 200 people? And they say yes or no. If they say yes, they order a brigade to go. Now, people can refuse to go because it's a volunteer assignment, but most everybody goes because most troops that come from Bangladesh or Fiji or China or Russia or wherever, they're kind of bored at home. And so they go for the excitement. They go because they feel they're doing some good in that country, and they go because the pay is also quite good. You get a considerable increase in your pay if you go, and it's for 6 months, so there isn't any peacekeeping training per se. They're trained as military people. They're disciplined. They can take care of themselves in the field, but when their 6 months is up, they're sent back home again.
Were you asked to make recommendations to the United Nations?
Yes, we met with the Undersecretary Generals and with the various ambassadors, including our own ambassador, Mr. Perkins. We don't really have any firm recommendations except to proceed with caution where we're going to introduce our forces. Because in March of last year, we had only 9,000 peacekeeping forces in the whole world, 9,000. Today, they're well over 50,000 in the 13 countries where they are present, and we're talking about adding more peacekeeping forces into Bosnia and Croatia, and of course now they're moving to send about 8,000 troops into Mozambique off the African coast, and at the rate it's going, the numbers of people involved are going to be so large as to be difficult to control the situations in each country. And also the costs are just absolutely ballooning, perhaps out of control, because the nations of the world seem somewhat reluctant to continue to support it financially.
So are you suggesting that the UN has to scale back its peacekeeping operations?
Not so much scale back, but be very careful about where they introduce new components. Once they decide to do it, then you have to fund it and provide the people and control it. There needs to be more control at the headquarters in New York. The Undersecretary General, Mr. Goulding, is a first-class British civil authority. He's very smart, but he has a very little staff, and he needs intelligence. He needs satellite information. He needs an operations room to deal with all these peacekeeping forces around the world. The UN is moving into a new era, and I hope they can adjust fast enough to accommodate the changes that are taking place in the world.
How come your trip examining peacekeeping forces didn't take you to Bosnia-Herzegovina?
Well, we had to receive the authority from the commander of the unit in that country, in every country, and he would not accept us. He has enough problems himself dealing with the Cyrus Vances and the Lord Owens and the congressmen, the senators, and the people from all over the world visiting there. They didn't need another independent body coming in, and we really didn't push to go there.
Now, you're about to go to Okinawa. What will you be looking for there?
Well, it's now some 45 years after the end of World War II. We still have a lot of military forces in Japan, including on the island of Okinawa. And it is our view that it is time now to bring those troops home. But the occasion for the visit actually is at the invitation of the governor of Okinawa to participate in an opening ceremony for a peace monument that is being dedicated in about 2 months. And they're going to list on that peace monument something that I think all nations ought to consider doing. That is, they're going to list the names of the dead, both the enemy and friend, that is the Japanese, the Okinawans, and the Americans, and the civilians. Everyone that was killed is going to be on that monument. And I don't know the number, but it's thousands and thousands who were killed. And that really is the story of war, a remembrance of those, all the people who were killed, not just the victorious ones.
So these will be people killed in Okinawa?
People killed just in the battle for that barren island of Okinawa. Lots of Americans were killed, lots of Okinawans, lots of civilians.
The world has changed since the end of the Cold War. Our military strategy, our foreign policy has changed. Do you feel that we're just experiencing changes, or do you feel that things have really become unglued?
Oh, I don't think that the world has changed tremendously since the end of the Cold War. Just the Soviet communism has disappeared. There's still much of the beauty, charm, and grace in the world that was extant before, and there's still much of the ugly, brutal coarseness that exists. And we cannot expect any immediate changes for the better or for the worse in the years ahead. But we must make sure that we in America stay strong economically, politically, and socially if we're to play a significant role in the world in the future.
Retired Rear Admiral Gene LaRocque. He's the director of the Center for Defense Information in Washington, D.C. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Ross Perot isn't the only Texan trying to stir up grassroots activism by addressing the people over the airwaves. We talk with self-described populist Jim Hightower. Next month, he launches a series of radio commentaries. We'll talk about farms, the farms his parents left, and the farms he tried to save as Commissioner of Agriculture in Texas. And every weekday at noon, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead turns off the CD player and turns on the TV soap opera Santa Barbara. Kevin comes clean about his obsession on the eve of the program's final episode. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President-elect Bill Clinton announced today more than 50 new appointments, nearly completing the White House staff lineup. NPR's Mara Liasson reports from Little Rock.
Most of the people appointed today are young. Most worked for Clinton during the campaign. Some were longtime aides from Arkansas. David Wilhelm, Clinton's campaign manager, will be the new chairman of the Democratic National Party. Wilhelm promised to spend the next 4 years developing a new Democratic majority for the 21st century. As expected, Clinton chose George Stephanopoulos, his spokesman during the campaign, as the director of the White House Office of Communications. And he made his campaign chief of staff, Boston businessman Eli Siegel, the director of the White House Office of National Service. As he announced Siegel's appointment, Clinton said nothing, he said, during the campaign generated as much enthusiasm as national service. Siegel will work to put into effect Clinton's plan to revamp the college loan program so that anyone who wants to go to college can pay for it by performing some kind of postgraduate community service. In Little Rock, I'm Mara Liasson.
And the New York Times reported today that Attorney General-designate Zoe Baird knowingly employed two illegal immigrants in her home. But Senate Judiciary leaders said tonight they did not expect this revelation to derail her nomination. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
According to Clinton transition officials, Zoe Baird and her husband employed a Peruvian couple to care for their child from 1990 until shortly after the election. Transition officials said Baird voluntarily disclosed the situation to President-elect Clinton before her selection as Attorney General and afterwards to the FBI and to senators charged with confirming her nomination. Transition officials acknowledged that the employment of illegal immigrants is a violation of the law, but they said, like thousands of other Americans in similar circumstances, Baird tried to rectify it by sponsoring the couple for legal immigration. Today, Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Joseph Biden and ranking Republican Orrin Hatch said they still expected Baird to win easy confirmation. Senator Hatch.
She made a mistake, like many good people do, and I get a little tired of the mentality in this country that mistakes mean people ought to be ruined in their lives.
If confirmed, Zoe Baird will be in charge of the Justice Department, including the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and its efforts to enforce the immigration laws. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
A Polish ferry ship turned over in the Baltic Sea early today during very stormy weather. It's believed that more than 50 people on board the ship died in the high waves and strong winds. Less than a dozen people were rescued. The ferry was traveling between Poland and Sweden when it capsized before dawn as the storm with hurricane-force winds hit the Baltic. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 4 points to close at 3,267.88 on volume of more than 280 million shares. This is NPR News. Officials at the Pentagon say that Iraq's southern air defense system has been badly damaged by Allied air attacks, even though 3 out of 4 targeted missile batteries were not hit. Yesterday, more than 100 U.S.-led warplanes struck at missile batteries in southern Iraq. Pentagon spokesman Pete Williams said today that bombs knocked out some air command and communication sites, but destroyed only 1 out of 4 Soviet-made missile batteries that were targeted. Earlier this week, U.S. officials indicated their concerns that 2 missile batteries posed a threat to Allied warplanes over a no-fly zone in Iraq. On Capitol Hill, Donna Shalala, nominated to head the Department of Health and Human Services, appeared before the Senate Finance Committee today. NPR's Joanne Silberner has more on the story.
Bill Clinton repeatedly promised during his campaign to reform health care. The senators at today's hearing were particularly interested in just who will be drawing up the new plans. Shalala has little direct experience in healthcare, but has built up a solid reputation as a manager at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, which she currently heads. Shalala told the senators that healthcare reform will be designed by a group with contributions from the White House and the Office of Management and Budget. If anyone is to play healthcare czar, it will be Clinton himself, she said. Shalala's hearing went smoothly, and she is likely to be confirmed as Secretary of Health and Human Services. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
The government says that retail sales moved up more than 1% last month for the best holiday season in 5 years. At the same time, the Commerce Department has revised sales in November down by 0.5%, after first estimating that they moved up 0.4%. The government says that sales rose 2.7% in the fourth quarter compared to the third quarter of the year. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jim Hightower doesn't like to be in the middle of the road, and he doesn't like it when he finds the Democratic Party there. He once said, "There's nothing in the middle of the road except yellow stripes and dead armadillos." You can bet he'll be coming up with more one-liners for the radio commentaries that he will syndicate beginning next month. Hightower used to edit the Texas Observer, then he went into politics. He was twice elected Commissioner of Agriculture for the state of Texas. He lost his third election in 1990. While he was commissioner, he co-founded the New Populist Forum, a network of state officials and congressmen. Hightower describes himself as a populist, but what does he mean by that?
I am a populist out of the old-time populist tradition of the 1870s, 80s, and 90s, people who basically believe that too few people control too much of the money and power, and they're using that power to control the rest of us. And that's what I find in the country today, that while I'm a Democrat, I have a lot of liberal notions myself. I also have a few conservative notions. I find most people a mix, and the true political spectrum isn't right to left. I would say maybe 20-30% of the people are either ideologically right-wing or left-wing. Rather, the true spectrum is top to bottom. And the vast majority of people no longer feel, even within shouting distance, Terry, of the powers at the top, both Democrat and Republican. I find around the country, as I travel and been doing a lot of speaking, that there's tremendous activism where people feel that they can make a difference when they feel that they count. At the local level, on school issues, environmental issues, economic issues. It's really ordinary people doing extraordinary things all across the country. I want to tap into those folks and bring their stories to a national audience.
You've been out of office for 2 years. In 1990, you lost the race for agricultural commissioner in the state of Texas. How does it feel to be out of politics now?
Actually, very good. There's a lot that I miss, in particular dealing with these, you know, amazing people who are out there, which we had the privilege of doing in the Agriculture Department. I don't miss the pressure to raise huge sums of money and the general just general pressure of politics and day in, day out, having to sort of be on and be campaigning. But for me, this is a chance to kind of through this radio show to do to apply a little entrepreneurship to my politics and to have that national forum and talk about a much broader range of issues. I guess I'd say that, Terry, my politics has never been dependent on my being in any particular office. I was 15 years a political activist before I ever ran for office, 8 years in office, and now expect to just continue right straight ahead with my viewpoint and issues hammering out there. So the luxury that gave me is that I was willing to lose. And that meant that I was willing to take on the chemical lobby, take on the Farm Bureau insurance lobby, take on the Bush administration, even the Democrats when they were wrong, knowing that that was making enemies that would, come home to roost. And they did, sort of about 40-ton chickens coming home to roost there on my head in 1990.
What does it do to your ego when you lose an election after you've won two of them? Were you crushed?
No, I've you know, I run on the basis that that I'm going to say what I believe in and try to actually deliver for the folks who put me there. Very odd notion, I know, in politics today. So it is never astonishing to me that I lose an election. My first race, 1980, for a railroad commissioner in Texas, I lost, but I ran well, ran very close. Same thing happened this time. You know, I lost out of 4 million votes, about 47,000 votes. I didn't lose on any of the issues that I had fought for. I didn't lose on my populist viewpoint. I lost in a classic kind of Lee Atwater attack, suggesting I was a flag burner. So had I lost on principles, had I lost on my viewpoints, been rejected, in, if you will, by folks who matter to me, then I would feel badly about it. But I don't. And my ego is not attached to the office. It's attached to my beliefs.
Is there a commercial that had you burning a flag or something?
Yeah, it was a rather classic one. It started with a long-haired guy setting a flag on fire and throwing it down on the ground, and then my picture came up out of the flag, suggesting that I was an advocate of flag burning, and had me tied, saying there was an FBI investigation of me, which there was not. And I have all these supporters out there who are soft supporters. You know, they like me, but they don't maybe know a whole lot about me. So they're watching that commercial in Dallas and Houston where it ran, and they're saying, "Well, God, I liked Old Hightower, but I didn't know he burned flags." So my problem was not just that commercial, but my own supporters thought I was going to win very handily, and the polls were showing that early on. So they didn't give me the kind of money I needed to have a TV campaign. So those ads went unanswered.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jim Hightower, who has a new radio commentary that will begin in mid-February, syndicated radio commentary in many stations around the country. Hightower is the former agricultural commissioner of the state of Texas. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jim Hightower, former Commissioner of Agriculture for the state of Texas, and also co-founder of the New Populist Forum, which is now called Democrats 2000. Now, you spent most of the 1980s as the Commissioner of Agriculture in Texas. You didn't grow up on a farm. Your father did. Why was agriculture that important to you?
Food is a tremendous issue to take to the people because it embodies so much of what can be right about our society and too often what is wrong with it. You can hold up a loaf of bread and talk about the penny that the farmer gets out of that. You can talk about the farm worker problems. You can talk about the environmental abuse that's embodied in that loaf of bread. You can talk about the monopoly power that controls the market in that bread. You can talk about consumer value being lost, not only in terms of price, but also in terms of the quality of the bread. So it's a wide range of issues to talk to people about all of the populist themes that I care about. It's also in Texas is an office where I could do something about what I was talking about. It wasn't like going to Congress and saying, "Hey, why don't we try to pass a law allowing farmers' markets to exist?" In this office, I could, and we did, establish 100 farmers' markets in the state. You could do things rather than just talking about it, and you could help the people you wanted to help, farmers, farm workers, consumers, et cetera.
I know one of the things you tried to do is to convince farmers to use less chemical pesticides or no chemical pesticides. How did you try to do that?
Well, we did it not only by pointing out market availability for it, but we did it the old-fashioned way of finding pioneers, those ordinary folks out there who do those extraordinary things. And there was one guy particularly, tell you a quick story, Terry, if I might, out in Mule Shoe, Texas. This is not a hippie center of our state. This is far west Texas. And this farmer named Jim Crawford out there, who farmed conventionally for 17 years, meaning he used the chemicals, he put the pesticides on there, but he was going to lose his farm. He had a 900-acre cotton and a corn farm. You know, that's not a science demonstration project. That's a real farm. But he was going to go broke because the price of corn was low and the cost of the chemicals, et cetera. So he began to think back about, well, his mother and them didn't use all those chemicals when they used to farm, so surely there's a way to do it. And investigate it and realize that organic farming means not just doing without chemicals, but building up your soil and learning the science of organic farming, which he did. And we have just beaucoup of manure stacked up in the feedlot, beside the feedlots out there in West Texas. So he began to take that and put it in the ground. And sure enough, after 2 or 3 years, he was getting 150% of the yield that he used to get out of that same old ground because he was putting the manure in it. That soil used a third less water than the old one did because it had the strength in it and the tilth. He got 1.5 times the price on that organic corn that he got on the conventional corn. So he became a disciple, an evangelist almost, of organic farming, not because he had any hippie epiphany, but because it made sense to him, made dollars, kept his farm for him. So he then became one of our teachers going across with great credibility, not me, a politician, not some academic or some think tank person, but a real-life farmer who had turned it around. And we had example after example of that all around the state. And then we made clear that this is where the market's heading. You can fight a lot of things in agriculture, but you can't fight what it is the consumer is saying they really want to buy. So it's common sense stuff. We linked the farmer to the consumer.
During your tenure as agricultural commissioner in Texas, did you see a lot of small farmers lose their farms?
I saw thousands of them lose their farms. And the bad news is there are thousands more losing them right now. Just because the TV cameras packed up and left a few years ago doesn't mean that it's not still going on out there. The saddest thing of all this is not just people losing their farms, but that it's the deliberate policy of government that is causing this. These aren't people who can't make it. These are folks like Jim Crawford and Muleshoe who are trying to keep up, who are desperately learning and finding new ways to do things. But a lot of them just get caught up in the crunch of low prices that are set by federal agriculture policy, of markets that are controlled by monopoly corporations, a desire by our own federal government to shove people down and ultimately off the land. There's an old saying out there that you can still make a small fortune in farming under these agriculture policies, but you have to start with a large fortune. And that's what a lot of them have done. I think it's a tragedy for the country because it's not a matter of a few farms. It's a matter of the opportunity to farm disappearing from us. And now with the North American Free Trade Agreement, with the GATT negotiations, with all these esoteric international agreements that are being hammered out in back rooms, we're going to see more farmers losing their land if we allow that stuff to go through, and actually substantial portions of our own food production leaving this country to go to places where, you know, they can take advantage of whatever whim they have involving pesticides, take advantage of very, very cheap labor, cheap land, subsidized interest, that sort of thing, and then ship all that back into our market.
I want to get back to farming. Your grandparents on your father's side, I believe, were tenant farmers in northern Louisiana. So your father grew up on a farm.
Yes, not in northern Louisiana, in East Texas.
Also
on my mother's side.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
So both your parents grew up on farms.
Yes. In fact, my mother grew up on they were not only tenant farmers, but basically subsistence farmers, mm-hmm. meaning they made everything. They had maybe a cash crop or two, but not much of one. They made their own soap, you know, that kind of thing. So today my mother, if it doesn't come prepared and if it doesn't plug into the wall, she's not much interested in going back to nature.
So what did your parents tell you about why they left the farm?
There wasn't any choice. In fact, my daddy told me that his mother had said when he got out of high school, or about the time he's going to get out of high school, get off this farm. There's not anything here for you. And so he took the interurban train, which existed at the time, from his from the town of Terrell, near where they farmed, over into Dallas, where he ended up getting a job, and later moving into Denison, where he met my mother. And it was shortly after he left the farm, in fact, that his own parents had to leave the farm. They migrated out to Arizona, and my grandfather, with my uncle, was one of the early hired hands out there, helped to put in some of the citrus orchards, which are now Charles Keating Savings and Loan Developments.
Do you ever wish you had the chance to live or grow up on a farm?
No, not actually. I have it in my genes to want to have be digging in the earth out there. But I've got a bit more of the roamer in me, the desire to move around and reach out and go beyond. And I did have the privilege because of my not only my grandparents but my aunts and uncles were farmers, so I spent a lot of time on the farms. But my work really is in trying to help people see that we're really linked together. That again, that notion, that old populist notion, that too few people control too much of the money and power, and that whatever our issue is, that's ultimately what we're fighting. Somebody said we might not have come over on the same boat, but we're in the same boat now. That's a very powerful unifying political notion, and I see myself as sort of a Johnny Appleseed of that notion.
Jim Hightower begins his syndicated series of radio commentaries next month. This is Fresh Air. I have a rundown of some of the stories coming up on All Things Considered. Lots of news on the presidential transition. Ted Clark reports that Bill Clinton said today that he will continue the Bush administration policy of forcibly returning Haitians who tried to enter the U.S. by boat. Mara Liasson examines the criticisms that Clinton is backing down on campaign promises. Also, the confirmation hearing of Donna Shalala, Clinton's choice to head the Department of Health and Human Services, and mounting controversy over Zoe Baird, Clinton's choice for Attorney General. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead wants to confess a dark secret, the reason he keeps the sound on his TV way down so his neighbors can't hear, the reason he never answers his phone between noon and 1 o'clock. Kevin is a soap opera addict, but this week he gets that daytime monkey off his back. The sun sets on Santa Barbara.
I get my sense of humor from my father, but I learned about critical thinking from my mom, watching soap operas with her when I was a kid. She had a genius for predicting where storylines were going months in advance. Mom taught me there were only four basic plot contrivances on soaps: amnesia, the mystery illness which induces a coma, split personality, and a woman torn between two men, and vice versa. My mother also taught me there was no reason to catch a soap more than once or twice a week, since they move slower than a Henry James novel. So I never watched them seriously. It wasn't until I was in grad school, one day when I had a ton of reading to do, that I was cruising the channels looking for an Adam 12 episode and came up on this Ward Cleaver-looking guy answering his doorbell and getting acid splashed in his face. I was hooked. The show was The Edge of Night, and I stuck with it for a couple of years as it wallowed in violence, corruption, psychosis, and death. Then it got canceled, and my days got back to normal, and I put the whole thing behind me as a fluke. Or I did till about 3 years ago, when I stayed for a few days with a frequently unemployed friend, a guy who does the shuffle around the house with a bathrobe and a beer routine when he's out of work. Come 3 o'clock every day, we had to watch Santa Barbara. At the time, it had a reputation as the most sarcastic of daytime shows, thanks mostly to actor Lane Davies as bitter wit and motor mouth Mason Capwell. But I was unmoved and didn't see the show again until the next time I visited my idle chum. After that, it was a skid down the slippery slope. I'd peek at the show maybe once every couple of weeks, then once a week, and then I was hooked again. The show started going to hell right after I got addicted to it. Even my friends stopped watching in disgust, but not me. Lane Davies quit the show in search of primetime success he hasn't found yet, and every actor who followed him made Mason less sarcastic and more of a puling wimp. Then the writers introduced all these sincere young people who took Warren Lockridge's college journalism class. One was a boy named Troy, who turned out to be a girl named BJ, who turned out to be a lifelong victim of child abuse by trusted family friend Frank, who got shot in the desert one night, leaving BJ as the prime suspect, except she had amnesia and couldn't remember if she'd killed him or not, when it was obvious to discerning viewers the real killer was Dolly, the scatterbrained waitress, who turned out to be a red herring because when BJ was on the witness stand, she suddenly remembered Frank had committed suicide. That left her free to marry Warren Lockridge, which I think happens tomorrow, which it had better, because come Monday, Santa Barbara will be history. The show really isn't worth watching anymore, which is why I'm glad it's been canceled, since I can't stop watching it on my own. Most of its lingering appeal is just the irresistible pull of narrative, any narrative. But it's also about how soaps have this Stalinist approach to reinventing history, writing characters into or out of families like they'd never been there or had been there all along. The best thing about watching Santa Barbara's final days is you get to see soap opera closure, a privilege akin to watching the Titanic go down. As the show does its dance of death, villains are killed off, killers are exposed, drifters drift, women come out of comas, couples are married off or reconciled, and BJ sells the TV rights to her tragic but inspirational life story. I'll miss the fact that Kim Zimmer's Jody still smokes cigarettes, at a time when it's more permissible to show a butt on TV than to smoke one. I won't miss much else, though it bothers me TV reviewers and culture critics don't pay attention to daytime programs, although the soap's aversion to resolving anything makes them TV's answer to Bebop, and though the ads, aimed exclusively at women, still portray them in the same stereotypical ways they did 30 years ago. But it'll be good to get that extra hour of afternoon back. It's like discovering daylight savings time in January. I know now how easy it is to get caught up in soaps, their singular rhythm and lulling repetitions. In this addiction-conscious time, I know I have to steer clear of what ails me. So I'll keep the TV off before sunset and resist one life to live, one day at a time.
Jazz critic and soon-to-be ex-soap opera addict Kevin Whitehead, he watches his last episode of Santa Barbara tomorrow. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our show was produced today by Fred Landerl. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Naomi Person directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Lorenzo Carcaterra grew up in a neighborhood where lots of the men beat their wives and kids, so Lorenzo and his mother weren't alone. But when Lorenzo was 12, he found out the family's secret. His father had killed his first wife. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Carcaterra about his new memoir, A Safe Place. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Dr. Harvey Schwartz, and we'll talk about what he calls a disorder of perfection. That's this Saturday at noon here on WHYY-FM,